Okay, so I'd like to begin by thanking also the organizers for this great conference and for giving me the opportunity to step in for Gerd Rempe on such short notice, who unfortunately was unable to attend the conference, and to talk to you about cooling and deceleration of polyatomic molecules. So my talk will kind of be in two parts. In the first part, I'll present our results on Sisyphus cooling of molecules, and in the second part, present a new deceleration technique for molecules. And not that it's really necessary, but I just have a brief motivation, kind of the typical fascinating applications of cold molecules, just kind of as a motivation for, you know, taking the great effort of trying to develop experimental methods to actually produce the required ensembles of cold and ultra-cold molecules. And these have generally fallen kind of in two separate categories. On the one hand, there are the indirect methods to produce cold or ultra-cold molecules, and on the other hand, so that the indirect methods where one starts with an ensemble of ultra-cold atoms and then tries to associate them into ultra-cold molecules. And on the other hand, the direct methods where one starts directly with a species of interest and then tries to cool this down to cold and ultra-cold molecules. And of course, on the one hand, the indirect methods have been very successful at producing molecules at ultra-cold temperatures, but are of course limited to relatively few and purely diatomic molecule species. And on the other hand, the direct methods are applicable to a very broad range of molecule species, but of course so far have been limited to relatively warm temperatures above on the order of 10 millikelvin or so. And so in our group, we basically focus on the direct methods. And these have generally, there's kind of been two methods which are often discussed. On the one hand, starting with a supersonic expansion. On the other hand, using a buffer gas source, where, of course, in both cases, one gets nice low-temperature ensembles of molecules. But, of course, in the first case, one still has a very high forward velocity, which then needs to be decelerated. In the second case, one has a cryogenic environment. And I also just want to kind of emphasize a third method, which often, I think, gets ignored a bit, maybe because of the disadvantage. Of course, there's no internal state cooling when one uses just an effusive nozzle to start with a cold ensemble of molecule. But really, it also has a very big advantage, is its extreme simplicity. And this really is a key advantage here. And of course, for all these methods, there's been some very powerful methods developed to manipulate the molecules based on the very strong interactions of polar molecules with electric fields. So in an electric field, one gets a Stark splitting into low and high field-seeking states. This allows us to trap molecules in electric field zeros, for example, in a quadruple guiding of molecules and all these techniques. And then, of course, this can be combined then with the effusive nozzles. So if we have an effusive source, then we can use this to select molecules from an effusive source. And this provides large fluxes, continuous beams in a very robust source of molecules. And this is kind of the workhorse method, which has been developed at the cold molecules group, in our group at MPQ. But of course, it also has the disadvantage of still, being relatively warm, producing molecules on the order of 1 Kelvin, and of course, no internal state cooling. And in the first half of my talk, I want to, in particular, focus on the first point of how we're now trying to cool the molecules down to lower temperatures. And so this is kind of the general framework, is how do we realize a general method to cool molecules to ultra-cold temperatures. And a first idea would be, well, why don't we just try what works for atoms, this being laser cooling. And of course, this has been shown to work very successfully for some specific molecule species. But in general, this is simply very difficult or maybe even impossible due to the large number of vibrational states. So a molecule which is excited to an electronical state will generally decay to a large number of different vibrational states. And one method actually we investigated for quite some time to circumvent this problem is to try to do cavity cooling, where the idea is to use a resonator to enhance one of these spontaneous decay channels, thereby creating a closed transition. And kind of the problem you run into when you try to do this is that, well, you still need on the order of 10,000s of scattered photons to actually cool the molecules. And so, I mean, just having one wrong decay in these 10,000 cycles still kind of kills you. And really, maybe the problem isn't so much that one has too many internal states, but maybe the problem is really that laser cooling is, in some sense, somewhat inefficient. I mean, the amount of momentum which is removed with each photon is really quite minuscule. And the question is, well, can't we replace the interaction strength with something a little bit stronger? And if we think about it, well, for molecules, what's the strongest interaction we have available? Well, it's basically the interaction with an electric field. So can we somehow replace the photon recoil in laser cooling with a different force, in this case with an electric field? And this led us to the following idea, which is which we called optoelectric cooling. So the idea is to create some kind of trap for molecules, an electric trap, with a high electric field strength at the edge of the trap and a preferably homogeneous field at the trap center. And of course, this translates then to an effective potential for the molecule. However, the nice thing about polar molecules is that the strength of this interaction depends on the orientation of the molecule in the electric field. Which means we have, say, one more weakly trapped state, one more strongly trapped state, and now the other key ingredient we need is some excited state which can decay to these two states. So we couple the more weakly trapped state to the excited state, have spontaneous decay to the more strongly trapped state. The final ingredient is a radio frequency which couples the two states at high electric fields. And if we now say we start with a molecule at a given energy inside this trap, indicated by this horizontal line, then the molecule can just oscillate around in the trap. And each time it passes the point where it's resonant with the radio frequency, there's a probability for it to switch states, in which case its kinetic energy at this point, of course, stays the same. So in the end, it has a total energy given by this line. And then once we're in the center of the trap, there is always an opportunity to be excited. We get spontaneous decay, and we see that this leads to an overall loss in energy. And so the key points here are that the electric fields extracts kinetic energy, whereas spontaneous decay is used for dissipation of entropy only. And the really nice thing about this scheme is that we can decrease the energy of the molecules on the order of the interaction strength with electric field, which can be on the order of 1 Kelvin per photon. And this just means that we need a really tiny amount of cycles to cool the molecules. And this just dramatically reduces the criteria for the spontaneous decay to get this whole thing to work. Of course, this is kind of still more of a level scheme for atoms, not really, I mean, you kind of can ask, well, how does this relate to molecules since, I mean, you have all these internal states. And so that's kind of the next topic, controlling the internal molecular state. And here a key point is that since we only need a very few amount of spontaneous decays, we're no longer bound to using electronic transitions. I mean, they're nice, of course, because you get fast decay rates, but vibrational decay rates can be on the order of 10 to 100 hertz. And this is certainly then fast enough to get a number of spontaneous decays in typical trap lifetimes. And of course, the advantage is that one basically automatically decays back to the vibronic ground state. At least if we assume some kind of harmonic approximation, then this is always given. One always gets a decay back to the vibrational ground state if one has a single excitation. But even, so this is, of course, in the framework of polyatomic molecules where there might be other more lower-lying modes. So in the harmonic approximation, one still always decays back to the vibronic ground state. And the other point is, of course, then angular momentum selection rules. And for this, I just want to briefly introduce the slight change in quantum numbers for polyatomic molecules, because in addition to the usual total angular momentum J and space fixed axis projection M, for symmetric top molecules, one has a very nice third quantum number, which is the projection of the angular momentum on the symmetry axis of the molecule. And then one distinguishes for symmetric top molecules so-called parallel vibrational transitions and perpendicular vibrational transitions, where in the case of parallel vibrational transitions, one has a selection rule delta k equals 0. In the other case, delta k equals plus minus 1. And the nice thing is, in the case of parallel vibrational transitions, since k doesn't change, it simply stays fixed. and we can kind of ignore it. Meaning one ends up with a relatively simple rotational picture, where if we start out in a given J state, we can excite the molecule to a V equal 1 state. In this case, it decays to a total of 3 different J states. And if we now have additional microwaves to couple these states, we still need only one laser to really control the internal molecular state of the molecule. And so how does this look for the scheme for the cooling? So this is the picture I just showed you on the previous slide. We have our 2 different states, our excited state. So in this case, we identify our excited state with, for example, we use a k equal 3 state. And in this case, if we're in a j equal 3, m equal 3, due to the condition that k always has to be less than j, we actually only decay for 1 to the j equal 3 state, the 2 different m states, and additional into a j equal 4 state. So we basically only have to deal with this total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 states, which is really quite manageable, basically by then adding additional microwaves to couple these lower states, we have a completely closed double system. So the key points are, so one key point is all these states are low field seeking, which is really crucial because, I mean, if we have a cooling scheme which takes a certain amount of time, then of course the molecules need to remain trapped during this time. A second point is, again, we only need one laser frequency for this cooling scheme with additional microwaves. And so this is basically a general approach to control the internal molecular state, certainly for symmetric rotor molecules, but also probably for molecules a little bit more in general if one adds additional microwave frequencies. Okay, so this brings me to kind of the experimental realization. The first molecule we've tested this scheme on is fluoromethane. The advantages are this is one of the simplest symmetric top molecules. It has a relatively strong permanent electric dipole moment, 1.85 debye. The kind of two key points for us is it has very large rotational constants. And kind of going back to my introduction, we're right now using this molecule without so just with an effusive nozzle, there's no internal state cooling, and this is then really key to start out in a manageable number of rotational states to make the whole scheme work. Kind of a very technical point for us also, there's very, very low background at mass 34 for detection of the molecule. And then for the actual cooling, we use the J equal 3 to J equal 4 rotational transition at 204 gigahertz, and the symmetric CH stretch mode at 2960 wave numbers for the cooling. And so then for the actual, so the two key points for the cooling, we need, of course, to provide the radiation sources. So we have a multiplier chain to provide the microwaves and a CWOPO. To provide infrared light at 3 micrometers. And the other key point, which I don't have really time to go into, but we have a very nice new design for an electric trap where we've achieved a very long lifetimes, up to half a minute actually by now. And also a key point is this design allows us to create relatively homogeneous fields in a large region of the trap, which is relatively important to be able to selectively address the transitions in the trap for the cooling scheme. So this brings me to the experimental sequence for the cooling. So this is again the cooling scheme I showed before, and this is kind of the integration of the trap into the experimental setup. So we start out with an effusive source of fluoromethane. We pre-cool it to 120 degrees approximately. Load the molecules into the electric trap. So this is the first part of the cooling sequence. Already during this time, we apply the microwave and infrared, and additionally apply the radio frequencies to the trap to do the cooling. And then a key point is, of course, at some point, the molecules no longer have enough kinetic energy to actually move up this hill sufficiently far to even see the radio frequency. So a key point to reduce the temperature by a large amount is to sequentially ramp down the radio frequencies to lower frequencies. For our first experiments, we've gone down from about a couple gigahertz down to 390 megahertz. And then we basically unload the molecules for detection to a quadruple mass spectrometer. Actually, in between, we also have a internal state discrimination technique. So a problem with detection with a quadruple mass spectrometer is it's not state selective. But by applying microwaves, we can basically eliminate those molecules from our trap, which are in the states we're interested in. And then kind of by doing a difference measurement, we can subtract all the molecules in other rotational states. So we do this scheme in a couple of different variations, just kind of, you know, as a reference with and without cooling. So on the one hand, so we have the scheme exactly as shown here. That's kind of our cooling result. As a reference, we do no cooling, where we just load molecules into the trap, shorten the storage time, and then directly unload with all the radiation fields switched off. And then also we have a kind of an intermediate step, because any signal increase, of course, if this cycle just takes place once, or if this optical pumping takes place once, basically what happens is molecules start out in more weakly trapped states, in states with a weaker confinement, and are then optically pumped to more strongly confined states. And so we also expect this to lead to an increase in signal. And then finally, we have a partial cooling, where we can simply stop the cooling, say, after 1220 gigahertz. And kind of as the most direct proof of cooling, what we can do is simply do a velocity distribution measurements, where we switch on and off the final segment of our quadrupole guide, and then take time of flight measurements. So this is what we get. So in the case of no cooling and accumulation, we actually get very similar time of flight distributions. The molecules arrive after about 15 milliseconds, which corresponds to about 10 meters per second. And you simply see a dramatic increase in the amount of in the time of flight. So this directly demonstrates that we've achieved cooling. We can actually directly calculate velocity distributions from these curves. In this case, the data is normalized, but here also the integrated signal shows the absolute number of molecules. So also we see that this accumulation, while it really isn't changing the velocity distribution at all, it does lead to a substantial increase already in the number of molecules in our trap. And then by cooling, we can also calculate average temperatures for these values. So we've cooled the molecules from 390 millikelvin down to 29 millikelvin in this first demonstration. And this is kind of the very brief version of the first half of my talk, which is we've achieved cooling by a factor 13.5 from 390 to 29 millikelvin. So kind of the next steps, there's kind of two points where we're going at the moment. The first is to work on additional manipulation of the internal molecular states. So we've been working on setting up microwaves for additional transitions in fluoromethane, coupling the J=4 to J=5 and the J=5 to J=6 states. And also we've set up our system to address additional infrared transitions with our laser. And this should allow us to access a lot of fascinating physics. We've seen first evidence of blackbody radiation in our trap on timescales of on the order of 100 or 200 seconds. We've actually been able to show that we do get some additional spontaneous decay channels to some other states. And in particular, we're hoping that with these systems, we're going to be able to demonstrate some internal state cooling as well. And also very fascinating, we're just getting started with a new molecule, formaldehyde. This also has a very large electric dipole moment, 2.3 dBi. It's of particular chemical interest, and a key point for us is it has a 4 times faster spontaneous decay rate, which we're hoping will really improve our experiment to the point where we can reach really ultra-cold temperatures, sub-millikelvin temperatures. Okay, this gets me to the second part of my talk, which is a new deceleration technique. And kind of as a rhetorical question, why decelerate polar molecules? And really a key reason for us is that our current approach, velocity filtering, more or less fails for heavier molecules. And this is simply because of the huge number of internal states populated. I think the talk by John Dahl yesterday, there were these numbers, 10 to the 8 or more states populated at room temperature. And this really kind of kills you if you want molecules in specific rotational states. And of course, the other techniques to produce molecules in the case of supersonic expansion, of course, we directly require a method for deceleration. But also the buffer gas techniques There's been the very nice work by John Doyle and DeMille and others on buffer gas sources, kind of in this hydrodynamic supersonic regime where one gets beam velocities on the order of 140 to 180 meters per second, somewhere in this range. And so certainly deceleration would be nice. But kind of the key problem for us with deceleration has been that all our techniques are based on using continuous beams of molecules. Whereas all deceleration techniques so far have basically operated in a pulsed mode. And this is really then a huge waste of potential to use a pulsed source to load a trap which is designed to load a continuous beam. And so the question is there some way to continuously decelerate molecular beams? And a somewhat trivial but complicated solution would be to just use gravitation. So it turns out to decelerate a molecular beam of 200 meters per second molecular beam, it would be sufficient to simply shoot it straight up by 2,000 meters. And I mean, in Munich, we do have mountains just to the south, which are this high. So it would be an option, but it would be kind of expensive. And it would be relatively difficult, I think, to get funding. And so the question is, well, maybe we can we somehow enhance gravity? And at first, this maybe sounds like science fiction, but I mean, it's really quite simple. Well, we can enhance gravity using a centrifugal potential. So can we somehow start out with molecules at the periphery of a spinning disk and then guide them to the center of the disk? And of course, I mean, we can, of course, try to mount a guide on a spinning disk. But this will again, you know, on first sight, it seems, well, this will again just be a pulsed source, because if we have some kind of external source, then only once per rotation are they going to be lined up to actually guide the molecules towards the center. But we came up with a relatively cool solution to solve this problem. And the idea is to kind of have an intermediate regime where of a half-fixed quadrupole guide. So here we start out with a quadrupole guide. So this is kind of a top view. So each line represents two electrodes. So we start out with a quadrupole, and then we have one pair of electrodes which are fixed in space, and a second pair of electrodes which are rotating. And so what basically happens is that molecules are injected from this stationary guide into a guide where two of the electrodes are stationary and the other two electrodes are rotating, which means that molecules can be injected for most of the time. And then we have a region where it's essentially an electrode starts where then all four electrodes are rotating, kind of a pickup, such that molecules can be guided into the center and then be extracted off axis, allowing us to use the centrifugal potential to decelerate the molecules. And we've been setting this up at our institute. And this is kind of the technical drawing. So the center is a spinning disk. Kind of this outside is the fixed electrodes. We start out here with the molecules being injected from a quadrupole guide. And then they're guided into the center and extracted off axis. This is kind of how it looks like in the actual realization with a blue and the red curves to emphasize the edges of the electrodes, and kind of a close-up of the technically most challenging regions. So here we have the extraction of the molecules off axis on the axis, the injection region here. So here we have our quadrupole injecting them into the half-moving guide, and also the pickup to actually extract the molecules onto the axis. So this is probably the most critical here. This part is moving at up to 100 meters per second. This part is fixed, and the distance here is 200 to 300 micrometers. So it's all relatively critical to manufacture. This is how the whole thing looks up in the setup. So we start out, again, as a demonstration for now. We're again just combining it with an effusive source, because it's simply it's the most robust source to test the whole system. We inject molecules onto the disk, we extract them off axis, and detect them with a quadrupole mass spectrometer. Okay, and so this is the really first signal we got. So what we were doing is simply switching on and off the voltage on the first guide and simultaneously slowly turning up the voltages. And it was just really exciting to see that as we turned up the voltages, we kind of start seeing a signal appear out of nothing. And I mean, this is just showing that we actually get guided molecules coming through the entire system. Yeah, since, I mean, this is the key part. I mean, once it's rotating, you're kind of, you hope that you still get molecules, but then we're able to test this kind of as a first signal as well. And so here what we do is we start out with the centrifuge aligned in such a way that the kind of non-guiding part, there's this part where guiding does not occur, and where this was aligned up with the injection region, which means we start out with no molecule signal, and then just by turning the centrifuge by hand, you know, you see your signal go up, and then it's just cool to see that you can actually get a signal for an arbitrary angle of the centrifuge. And here we managed to rotate the centrifuge by hand, I think up to 1 hertz, so I think we were decelerating the molecules here by about 1 meter per second. So of course, to really get interesting, you have to attach the whole thing to a motor. So we rotated the centrifuge up to 30 hertz. And what was really exciting here is that we actually, I mean, usually we kind of expected the signal to stay constant when we turn up the speed. But what we actually saw is that our signal actually went up once we turned the centrifuge faster. And this is relatively unusual if you actually get something to work better than you expect it to. So what's also nice here is to see that really, I mean, in the when rotating at basically no speed, where you just have an angle dependence, you get these bigger regions where molecules are not guided simply because the guides don't line up properly. But when you rotate at higher speeds, you really see that this region gets filled in. And part of the reason is that simply, I mean, this non-guiding part is where this section lines up with injection region. But once this disk is spinning at a fast enough speed, molecules kind of get injected where they line up, and basically by the time some molecules which would be injected here which are missing would have to move a full circle to actually reach the extraction region to go into the center. But before these missing molecules actually, you know, before you notice they're missing, you've gone a whole revolution, and therefore the no signal region actually fills up, and you really get a true continuous signal of molecule from the centrifuge. Okay, and then kind of as a final proof of actually decelerating the molecules, we can use a relatively nice effect, which has been kind of a pain in the past, which is if you run a fuse of nozzle at relatively high pressure, one gets a boosting effect, where basically the slow molecules get eliminated from the source. And so what we do is we run the centrifuge at the low velocity, where we have no at very high pressure, where we get no molecules at low velocities, and then we can turn up the rotation speed, and this is really what leads to this large increase in signal, because we have plenty of molecules at very high speeds at the big bend radius at the periphery of the centrifuge, which then gets slowed down into the center, and we simply get this we just get these fast molecules to be decelerated to the slow velocities and see this very nice increase in signal. And really to see this effect very dramatically, this increase in signal at slow molecules, we can compare the count rate of molecules below 20 meters per second for a zero rotation speed and for the high rotation speed for the deceleration. And whereas for the without the rotation, we basically only get relatively small signals below 20 meters per second at very low nozzle pressures. We just get a huge signal of molecules when the centrifuge is rotating. And the key point is that these molecules below 20 meters per second are precisely those molecules which are interesting to load an electric trap for further experiments. And I just also want to emphasize, I mean, that's the very nice thing about these guiding techniques is they're very general. So we've also used the deceleration for fluoromethane, for trifluoropropyne. It's really just a matter of attaching a different gas bottle and setting the mass spectrometer to a new mass. Okay, so this brings me to my summary and outlook. So I've shown our demonstration of Sisyphus cooling, where we've reached a temperature reduction by a factor 13.5, phase-based density increase by a factor 29. We've demonstrated now our centrifuge decelerator, allowing us to achieve this continuous deceleration of molecular beams with a large signal of molecules amenable to trap loading. And this should give us the opportunity to explore lots of interesting new physics. And with that, I'd like to thank all the people involved in these projects, in particular Barbara Englert, Rosa Glöckner, Alexander Prehn, and Martin Ibriga are involved in the Sisyphus cooling project, Zotia Shevenkov, Jing Wu, Andreas Rolfes, and the newest student, Thomas Gantner, are involved in the centrifuge and also our cryosource project. All this work is taking place in the group of Gerd Rempe. And I'd also like to advertise the two posters on the subject by myself and by Jing Wu on the two projects. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Martin. John?
I just have two questions. For the trap, what is the density and number? And for the decelerator, what is the flux, a typical flux, coming out of the decelerator?
So for the trap, we have for the cooling, after the cooling, we have about 10 to the 6 molecules in the trap at the moment. And for the decelerator, I think for below 20 meters per second, it was on the order of 10 to the 9 molecules per second. But of course, I mean, this is right now combined with the effusive source. So, I mean, the whole system is designed to be combined with probably the buffer gas source, in which case, of course, we hope to get substantially higher fluxes. I mean, the key point is that you kind of get out what you put in for both the trap and the decelerator. Just using it with a different source will, of course, give you much higher numbers.
Very interesting. So in terms of you're cooling by basically sort of exciting on the CH stretch. So this is, and the parallel band, obviously, it's just one. Is it CHF3 or CH3F?
CH3F.
So what problems do you have in terms of, let's say, Fermi resonance interactions between the symmetric stretch and the overtone of the band? So in other words, you talk about the purity.
Fluoromethane is relatively awful in that respect.
Okay, so that's one of the reasons why you want to go to formaldehyde, I presume?
We hope it's better. Actually, I mean, it's awful, but it's really not that bad. So we estimate that about 10% of spontaneous decays go to the wrong channel.
Okay. So, but if 10%—that's why it's confusing why you're doing so well, because if 10% go to the wrong channel, and you need something like, what?
10 cycles, maybe.
So only 10 cycles.
That's defined.
So that's all right. So you'd only lose a factor of 2 in that process.
Certainly acceptable. Yeah.
Okay. Good. And what about the? I mean, if you were to really go to, let's say, you know, let's invert the molecule. Let's think about it as being CHF3. And now really excite the symmetric CF stretch. I mean, the oscillator strength for that is probably 20 to 30 times larger than it is for the CH stretch.
What?
The oscillator strength for the CF.
Well, but it's also a much lower frequency, which means you typically have smaller spontaneous decay rates.
It's only a factor of 3, and that's true, and it comes as the square. But I think you still win in terms of what the radiative lifetimes are.
CF3H, I think still the CH stretch mode has the highest spontaneous decay rate.
And what is your spine? It must be 50 milliseconds at best.
Yeah, 15 hertz.
15 hertz.
15 hertz.
Okay, all right. So 150, 15 hertz. So, yeah, all right. So 70 milliseconds or so.
Yeah.
Okay. And you think the CF stretch is actually...
Yeah, I have numbers. I mean, okay, it's based on, I think, quantum chemistry calculation, but there's also papers on, I mean, we've looked up the numbers.
Basically. Okay, all right.
There are some examples. For example, the trifluoro, chlorobromo, and iodomethane, they all have very strong, I think, CF stretch modes, but the CF3H specifically does not. So it varies, basically.
Okay. Do you have problems also with Coriolis interactions between the symmetric stretch and the asymmetric stretch in your CH stretch manifold?
I really have to admit, I'm not that much an expert on which exact interactions we have. We see some spontaneous decay to other channels. So actually, one thing we see... So what we see is if, so this is kind of our technique to look at what states we're in, where we're basically, we have the signal after cooling, and then we can apply microwaves to eliminate the molecules in our states of interest, which gives us this green curve. But we can also apply the cooling where we simply leave off our laser, which gives us the black curve. So what this kind of shows is that there's molecules left in other states which are clearly addressed by the laser, which means they have to basically be in this J equal 3 or K equal 3 type states, but they're no longer in the states J equal 3 or J equal 4. And what we've actually done now is to apply these microwaves to also deplete the states J equal 5 and J equal 6, and then we see that this green peak disappears. So this shows that we get spontaneous decay from the state 333 to J equal 5 and J equal 6. We're pretty sure this is happening via an intermediate decay via one of the other vibrational modes. But which exact path this is,
one doesn't know.
Difficult to tell.
Interesting, thanks.
You mentioned in your talk some evidence for internal cooling. Could you go into slightly more detail and say what you've seen so far, or what your ideas are to do internal cooling?
So basically, the idea is to we have the different J states, and it's basically optical pumping to lower J. I can probably on paper this would be easier to sketch, but I mean, if we apply additional laser to excite the J equal 5 to J equal 5 excited state, and maybe microwaves to couple the J equal 5 to J equal 6 in the ground state, then we again get the decay from J equal 5 to J equal 4 and can kind of shuffle down. I mean, with enough radiation sources, you can principle, you know, extend this indefinitely to couple all the states in the K equal 3 manifold. So this is kind of the idea.
Okay, yeah, I have a question in terms of the electro-optical cooling. Since you have protons present, you also have nuclear spins and hyperfine. Does that provide any complications here, or is it essentially passive, or do you need extra frequencies, or how do you handle that?
In fluoromethane, we have only spin 1/2 and spin 0 molecules, so the hyperfine structure is below a megahertz. We have not resolved it to this point. So certainly in molecules with quadrupole moments, this is going to be a big issue. I mean, obviously you can get hyperfine splittering up to many hundreds of megahertz, and in this case, you're going to need to adapt. It remains to be seen whether this is an advantage or disadvantage. Can be an advantage, maybe even it maybe helps suppress some trap losses if you get more avoided crossings. But of course, you also need to make sure you remain in low field seeking states all the time.
Just a very short question. I mean, does the centrifuge, is it also efficient for isotopic separation? I mean, do you have to have a pure sample of heavy those complicated molecules, or I mean, you just turn the thing in the fact that you will be able indeed to separate different isotopes?
So I mean, the centrifuge, what comes in the center, is if you do the math, it's precisely those molecules which have exactly twice the rotation speed at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So if you have a source where different isotopes have a different initial rotation, a different velocity, then yes, you could tune it to have one species come to the center and another one not. But of course, if you, for example, seed the molecules in a supersonic beam, then the seed gas is going to determine the velocity of the beam and not the mass of the molecules itself. So, I mean, maybe a bit of a different principle.
Okay.
Yeah. You didn't say very much about the trap in your in the first part of your talk, although I know that took some time to develop. But would this technique work only for that kind of trap, or could it work for a variety of different types of traps?
So the key advantage of our trap is that, I mean, we're trapping molecules between a pair of capacitor plates, allowing us to have relatively homogeneous fields in the trap center. And this is actually right here the nice demonstration of the usefulness of having these homogeneous fields, because, I mean, these molecules would not be split up at all. I mean, of course, there might be hyperfine structure, but except for that, they wouldn't be split up at all in no field, and in say quadrupole trap, you'd get gigahertz of Stark broadening here, and it would be completely impossible to distinguish these individual states. Whereas in our trap, we can relatively well already individually address all these transitions, and this is what allows us, for one thing, to remain in trap states, for another, to try to do things like really see in which of these states we are, to pump the molecules in only in a single one of these states. So that's really the advantage of this trap design. But I mean, something like an Iofi-Pritchard trap might work relatively well as well if you have a very high but flat enough bottom, so that you can still select the transitions. And you just have to make sure that you avoid transitions which lead to untrapped states. That's the key point.
Anyone back there have a question? Yes.
Is the limit to your cooling right now technical or theoretical, or are there theoretical limits to the cooling?
Yeah, so I mean, I was already discussing our losses at the factor two, for example, from landing in other states, are relatively low spontaneous decay rates. So the problem is we're kind of hemorrhaging molecules as we go along, and we already have relatively small signals. And by the time we've cooled this factor 10, this it just gets more and more difficult each step to keep optimizing the cooling cycle. So this is really it's a purely technical limitation at this point of having enough signal to keep going, and this is where we're hoping that formaldehyde will also really help. If we can just move along faster, we can avoid losses better, your factor 4 will of course really help. Maybe we can get four orders of magnitude instead of one order of magnitude. That would be the nice thing. We'll see.
So regarding your molecule centrifuge, the impressive structure, could you explain a little bit the complexity of this Swiss cheese structure? It looks like a beast to make. So
so this is basically the Swiss cheese is kind of two reasons. The first is reducing the weight a bit. And the second is we use the holes to balance the whole structure. I mean, so for example, there's more holes here on the opposite side of the curve region, because here there's missing mass, so there's more holes here to make up for it.
So they're not precisely positioned
no,
at just those places.
More.
Okay. Yes.
Since you're aiming towards formaldehyde, I'm wondering if you could, because some of the ideas that you were talking about with the methyl fluoride, relied on K being a good quantum number. So how does that scheme change when you have only near isometric top or near symmetric top rather than a pure symmetric top?
And this is nice about formaldehyde, because you can say, well, it's not a symmetric top anymore, but it really kind of is. Because especially, I mean, the k equal 3 states, I think the splitting is only on the order of a couple megahertz. So, I mean, at our current temperatures, this basically can treated completely like a symmetric top. I mean, if we really go low, if we get below a millikelvin, we'll probably maybe need to start adjusting for this, and maybe it creates some complications. Maybe you need an offset field to kind of get the splitting of the levels, where, of course, then the trap design might really be helpful again, so that remains to be seen. But I mean, getting to the point where this becomes an effect for formaldehyde would, of course, be very nice in the first place.
Thank you.
So this would probably be an experimental tour de force if it's even possible. But if you combine your scheme for the cooling with the cavity cooling, then that would both enhance the spontaneous emission and also reduce the transitions to unwanted levels, and it could be a perfect combination.
It sounds like a perfect combination. I mean, the problem is the biggest problem. I mean, we were thinking right in this beginning at the in this direction at the beginning, but I mean, the problem is also you have to kind of cover the whole trap volume, and I mean, we have a cubic centimeter trap volume at the moment, and matching a whole cubic centimeter to a optical cavity at a high finesse is basically impossible.
All right, thank you for a great session. We'll reconvene at 11.